Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The list of things money cannot buy you goes like this: love, happiness, and, as we learned again last night, votes. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 11th of June, Wednesday today. Good as always to have you with us. Go ahead and put this date in your political calendars, everybody. June the 19th, that is 8 days and counting. House Republicans are going to meet to pick their new majority leader. Eric Cantor announced this afternoon he's going to step down as the number two in the House GOP following his stunning primary loss last night. Marketplace's David Gura has been following the story for us all day in Washington. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
Before we get to Mr. Cantor and what his loss means, let's talk about Mr. Bratt for a second and what his win means. There is money in this race, but not a whole lot of it on Mr. Bratt's side, right?
Yeah, just to compare the two war chests here, Eric Cantor raised, I think, more than $5 million, and David Bratt raised $200,000. So that's much smaller. That's a big discrepancy. And, you know, there are a few takeaways there. The first is, and I think Tea Party groups are going to be saying this all day, is that this shows how important it is to organize at the local level, get people energized, get them to the polls. And, you know, there's this other argument. I think it's an important one, and that is, by having so little money, I think that David Bratt was able to escape some of the scrutiny that was applied to Eric Cantor. And you know, that says a lot about politics today, sort of the way that we measure the might of a candidate has to do in large part with how much money he's raised.
Right. Which turns out not to be dispositive in this case.
Right.
I cannot even believe I'm saying this, but we are only 9 months away from another debt limit fight. Conservatives and Tea Partiers are now, I think it's fair to say, emboldened, right, for that debt limit fight coming up in March of 15.
March 2015, somewhere around there. And I caught up with a guy named Steve Ryan. He's a government affairs person, a lobbyist. And you know, he says it's hard to understate sort of what this loss means, what Eric Cantor's defeat means.
I mean, it unsettles the firmament. There's a ripple in the force, as we would say. And it's just totally unpredictable now what's going to happen out of that.
And Ryan told me what he always has respected about Cantor is how good a manager he is. And there have been some points where that hasn't been great. We remember very, very vividly when there was almost a deal between Speaker Boehner and President Obama, and that fell apart in large part due to Eric Cantor. But, you know, what Ryan told me is that, you know, the Republican Party is going to miss how effectively Eric Cantor was able to manage these different groups within the party.
Others who will miss Eric Cantor, item one on that list, Wall Street banks. The Chamber of Commerce came out today and literally said, we will miss Eric Cantor. He was a friend of business and business was a friend of his.
Yeah, again, his effectiveness as a manager had to do with how well he could bridge these different groups. And Tea Party Republicans trusted him, and so did Wall Street. And there have been these ups and downs. But someone who knows Cantor told me that he's really gifted in a small room. And so you've got a banker, you've got somebody from Wall Street coming down worried about what's happening. That person can bend Eric Cantor's ear. He's going to listen to them. He's going to give what they're having to say a lot of credence. He's going to listen. He's going to hear them out. They really respected that, and I think they're going to miss it.
Not far from big business are the lobbyists in Washington on K Street. Also, no stranger to Mr. Cantor.
Yeah, there's this kind of unfortunate story. Yesterday, of course, was Election Day in Virginia, and it's been reported that Eric Cantor was not in Richmond, his home district, in the morning. He was here in D.C. on Capitol Hill having coffee with lobbyists at a Starbucks.
Man.
So, yes, he was very close to them. They knew that they could talk to him, that he'd listen to them. I should point out he's also a great fundraiser. He's raised a lot of money for the Republican Party. He's traveled an awful lot doing that. And indeed, a criticism of him in light of what happened yesterday is that he was on the road so much, he probably didn't spend as much time as he should have back in his home district.
And he was on the road, one supposes, to raise money and generate goodwill for a bid for speakership, right? For the speakership.
Exactly, yeah. You know, he's somebody who's incredibly young when you look at sort of the pantheon of leadership, both in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party.
I mean, using that word pantheon loosely, is that what you are?
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, look at the Democratic leadership. Everyone's sort of in their 70s or around their 70s. Yeah. You know, same sort of true of the Republican Party. He was a really young, up-and-coming leader who was, as you say, on track to be Speaker of the House. And that's history.
Quickly before we go, David Bratt, he is an economist by training, right, at Randolph-Macon.
That's right. If you go to his webpage, you can see there's a picture of Hayek and a picture of Keynes. Yep. You know, you can thumb through his CV and see that he's a real devotee of Ayn Rand and sort of free market economics. You got to think, you know, he'll be under more scrutiny now going forward, but that's going to sort of translate to how he approaches a lot of policy issues going forward.
And we should say, assuming he wins in November, he's only one of 435, right?
That's exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right.
I mean,
right.
Let's keep that in perspective. David Gura in Washington for us. David, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Guy.
So, Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia. As I said, David Bratt is an economics professor there, the same school at which the Democratic nominee in Virginia's 7th Congressional District is on the faculty as well. Jack Trammell is his name. He teaches sociology. All of which is to say, two guys in one very high-profile congressional race from a small school that most of the country had never really heard of before last night. So, is there, as the business types like to say, upside potential for Randolph-Macon in this whole thing? Sally Herships has that story.
You can't buy this kind of PR. Randolph-Macon, a small liberal arts college outside Richmond, is all over today's news, like just now. Dan Hurley is with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities.
While this may be short-lived, I think if you were to look at kind of the placement of the Randolph-Macon College name in the media, it would be a very high number.
Hurley says this kind of marketing is worth millions. Typically, a school would have to have a winning football or basketball team to get this kind of press. Like a few years ago, when Butler University in Indiana made it to the NCAA Final Four.
That impacted them in terms of inquiries, application, and enrollments for a number of years.
Jim Paschal is president of Paschal, Stapleton & Lord, a higher education marketing firm. He agrees having two congressional candidates come out of one college sure can make a school look good. But he says he's wary. 5 months can be a long time under the microscope.
You know, if this becomes a very divisive campaign and it's seen as mudslinging between these two candidates, I don't think it's going to reflect positively on the college.
No chance of that, says Randolph-Macon's president, Robert Lindgren.
These are two very principled, honest folks who will debate the issues and not do some of the typically political things that you might find in a congressional campaign.
Uh-huh. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Away from politics, back to the economy for a second. On Wall Street today, traders were a little bit off their feed, I guess you'd say. Just a little, though. Not a lot. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The World Cup begins in Brazil tomorrow. It's the start of a month in the global spotlight. An event not without its problems, it must be said. Stadiums unfinished, costs skyrocketing. We've got the BBC's Katie Watson on the line from Sao Paulo to see how things are coming together. Katie, it's good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
I was going to start with a question about the infrastructure down there and how it's all shaping up, but I think what I should really do is just ask you about your drive across town to get to the studio to talk to us. It was no fun.
It was no fun, but it's never any fun in this city. I mean, it's a city of 11 million people, 20 million in the greater Sao Paulo. And your guess is as good as mine whenever you can get from A to B. And obviously, it's been worse in the last few days because we've had a metro strike here. So just getting on buses with huge queues has certainly got a lot of people very frustrated.
Once you get on a bus and you get out to a stadium, are the stadiums ready or are we going to see the Sochi thing of no restrooms and things in disarray?
Well, I was at the stadium this morning. Now, I was at the stadium about 2 weeks ago as well, and there's been a big change. The stadium itself looks pretty finished, but it's walking around the corridors. There's still a lot of like tape on the floor and boards around. It's really cosmetic, I think, the issue is now, but there is still a lot of tidying up to do, skips around. I think it'll be a very, very long night for the people down at the stadium.
Do I have to pay whatever the equivalent in reals is? Do I have to pay like $15 for an ice cream on the streets? I mean, are we seeing that happening, as always happens at these events?
Well, I'm not sure about how much it will cost at the stadium. There has been a bit of concern that, especially in Rio, actually, there's a campaign that's called the Rio Surreal, so the Surreal Real, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And there's been a campaign on Facebook saying, you know, the prices here were crazy. And that's really got a lot of support, actually. People have been frustrated. And that's the issue across the country, because inflation's about 6%. And hyperinflation, if you remember back in the 90s in this country, was scary. So yes, there is that concern. People are worried, but I've been speaking to experts who say the fear is there, but the hyperinflation is not likely to return.
What about everyday people worrying or actually speaking out about the government spending so much money for this World Cup and then the Olympics in a couple of years? Has that been squashed, or is it still a topic of conversation?
No, it's a huge topic of conversation. It's quite interesting because obviously Brazilians love football. So you ask them, you know, do you love football? They say yes. And you ask them, do you like the World Cup? And then it's a very different answer. A lot of people are very cross about the World Cup. And it's the perceived spending, because in fact, Dilma Rousseff last night, president, gave a speech on television, on radio, ahead of the World Cup. And she said this, you know, this isn't actually, it's a false dilemma. The amount of money spent on stadiums and infrastructure is nothing like the money that's being spent on health and education. But the gripes are still there. This is a country of 200 million people. The healthcare system isn't great. The public education system isn't great. People feel that they're spending a huge amount. Taxation here is high, and they feel that their taxes aren't going anywhere. So people here are frustrated seeing these gains and thinking, actually, it's not as good as it was.
Katie Watson is the BBC South America business correspondent. We got her in Sao Paulo, Brazil, a day ahead of the opening of the World Cup. Katie, thanks very much.
Thanks.
The Harvard Business School launches a new online program today. It will not, I am sorry to have to tell you, get you that $100,000 HBS MBA for free. It is instead the latest in the long list of attempts by elite universities to expand digitally without tarnishing the brand. And about that, it seems higher education could learn a thing or two from the fashion industry, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
You may not remember Pierre Cardin, but in the 60s and 70s, his name was synonymous with very high fashion. Models in Vogue posed in his futuristic dresses. He dressed the Beatles. Today, I paw through a stack of Pierre Cardin men's shirts on a table at Sears. Polyester and cotton, on sale for $17.99. You see, Cardin had another claim to fame. He was the first high-end designer to expand his brand to the masses. He put his name on everything, from baseball caps to toilet seat covers.
He took a very powerful designer marquee brand and diluted it to the point where it had no value and no meaning.
Mark Cohen teaches retail marketing at Columbia Business School. He says elite universities face a lot of the same challenges as luxury brands. How to expand without losing what makes Versace, Versace, Gucci, Gucci, and Harvard, Harvard.
The parallels hold up. They have to retain their exclusivity and retain the basis through which they're held to be elite.
There are colleges that are just very concerned about diluting their brand.
Ben Woldofsky is the director of higher ed studies at the Rockefeller Institute of Government at the State University of New York. He says it's not only going online that has schools nervous.
Just the idea of setting up a campus in a different country where you give degrees is something that, you know, places like Harvard, Yale, Princeton worry about a lot.
Woldofsky says part of the value of top-tier degrees is that they're exclusive, they're expensive. elite schools can't afford to hurt their relationship with past and future students by becoming common. But schools like Harvard also need to grow. Bharat Anand is a professor at the B School and faculty chair of the new program.
Our mission at Harvard Business School is to train and educate leaders who make a difference in the world. Now, it would be a perfect coincidence if there were only 900 persons every year who fell into this category who could come to our physical campus.
He says there are a ton of talented students out there that Harvard's not reaching. Enter the new pre-MBA online. It's got a different name, HBX. And yes, it's more accessible, but...
at the same time, we're charging.
$1,500 for three courses. The payoff is a certificate, not Harvard course credit. It's a little like a silver necklace from Tiffany. No diamond ring, but it still comes in the blue box.
We're not offering any of our MBA courses online. This is an entirely new program to an entirely new group of participants.
The plan is for HBX to expand beyond intro business classes. But as it does, it runs another risk familiar to retail, that customers will trade down, abandoning another huge profit center, executive education. Ezekiel Emanuel is a professor at Wharton, which is also trying to figure out the online play. He says the stakes for all top-tier schools are high.
Hundreds of millions of dollars for each elite business school, but in particular, there are tens of millions of dollars in the continuing education and the executive education space, and I think that's what people fear the first.
He says about a fifth of Wharton's revenue comes from executive education programs. It makes up about a quarter of Harvard's business school revenue. And there's fear that corporations will tell their execs to just go online instead. So far, Emanuel says that's not happening at Wharton. People are choosing traditional school over online classes.
Obviously, there's going to be some challenge as we go forward, clearly differentiating them and making the value of each clear to people.
It's a tightrope luxury retail has been walking for a long time. The goal for elite colleges is not to wind up with their brand name products wadded in the sale bin. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
We've got a list of online programs at some of the top schools in the country and their price tags at marketplace.org/learningcurve. Coming up.
And I tell you what, Kai, you take a young man from making $30,000 a year to $140,000 a year in 5 years, that's the American dream.
Business is booming in barges, but first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you are. The Dow Industrials unloaded 102 points today, 0.6% down to 16,843. The NASDAQ deleted 6 points, about a 10%, 43.31. The S&P 500 dipped 6 points, a third of 1%. Finished at 19.43. The World Bank reduced its global economic growth forecast for 2014 from 3.2% down to 2.8%, largely because of Ukraine and the cold U.S. winter, believe it or not. H&R Block calculated a gain of 4.67%. Anadarko Petroleum sprouted up 4.25%. Today, the Texas company is rumored to be a takeover target by ExxonMobil and others. ExxonMobil XOM rose a half of 1% today. Bond prices didn't move too much. The yield on the 10-year T-note inched down to 2.63%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at marketplace.org by June 30.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for May. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's the 36th annual Superman celebration getting underway in Metropolis, Illinois. And in Cooperstown, New York, the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum celebrates its 75th anniversary. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hey, remember the big Target credit card breach? Yeah, of course you do. Stupid question, right? You know who else remembers, though? Businesses. Banks had to crank out millions of new cards for their customers who'd had their data stolen, new account numbers, to be more specific. And that switcheroo was a big problem for for the businesses that rely on subscriptions and monthly memberships. From WMFE in Orlando, Florida, Amy Kiley has more on that.
Rocky Arbitel hates this sound.
Uh-oh.
That's a scanner rejecting a membership card for Arbitel's Orlando business, the gym downtown. Unfortunately, it's what greets about 30% of people coming here to work out. Many just haven't updated their credit card numbers on file. In his office, Arbitel points to a computer screen.
That is the decline list. That's all the credit cards that were dishonored, declined since January. And it's $57,000 worth of cards.
He says if his business hadn't been stable before this, it might not have survived. At an e-commerce expo across town, payment experts focus on what made customers change credit cards in the first place. Fraud.
Make sure that you're putting into your plan for the next 12 months some more money and some more resources to protect your company from fraud. Thank you so much.
Preventing fraud is a big topic of this expo, but so is dealing with it when it happens. Dan Burkhardt is CEO of Recurly, a subscription processor. He says when customers get new credit cards, they can sign up to automatically give those numbers to any business they use. Banks and credit card companies just put the information in a database, and merchants check it.
And for any match that occurs, this service will provide the replacement card, and then the transaction is processed with the new replacement card.
Here's the catch. To use the database, businesses have to pay to work with specific credit card processors. Some big companies don't do that, let alone the corner gym. Stephen Casco says limiting access slows innovation for everybody. He's CEO of the company that set up the e-commerce expo. It's called CardNotPresent.com. His solution to the subscription problem is competitive cooperation.
We in America invented the very idea of e-commerce. So I would say, do we have problems with what's going on right now? Absolutely. Are we best suited to solve it and have the rest of the world look to us as the model? You better believe it.
Casco says it's even time to look beyond credit cards themselves. He flips through the expo schedule and points to a name of someone doing just that.
I'm Shant Sarkissian. I'm the founder and CEO of Cortex MCP.
Sarkissian's company offers a mobile wallet. Here's how it works. People put a specific amount of money on their phones.
When I'm ready to make a payment, I just go in, I select the one I want to use, click Use Now, enter my PIN, hit Pay, boop, that's it.
A thief can only steal that amount, not drain an entire account. Other ideas include Bitcoin, biometric identification, and chip and PIN machines. In the end, Casco says, from the cable company to the corner gym, merchants will have to try something. After all,
actually getting paid is the core of that business. So there's no way around it. You have to become educated.
And this subscription problem isn't over yet. The largest banks have replaced about 21.8 million cards since the Target security breach. That's only about half the cards affected. In Orlando, I'm Amy Kiley for Marketplace.
Forget trucks and trains and planes. For sure, a whole lot of cargo in this country moves not on roads or on rails, but on water, barge traffic on the big rivers. Austin Golding runs his family's barge business out of Vicksburg, Mississippi. We have him on from time to time to talk things over. Mr. Golding, good to talk to you again, sir.
Thanks for having me.
How's business, just as a way to get started?
Business has been good so far this year. We are seeing an increase in our industry, an increase in demand. And the economy, at least in our sector, has rebounded to the point where we're all enjoying a fruitful time period right now. But I think we're all still sharing some cautious optimism.
You transport oil products, as we have talked about before, petroleum products. I imagine that fracking boom is just doing you guys a world of good.
We've really benefited as becoming a true source of quick transportation for anything fracked in this country. You know, the domestic crude oil, the natural gas, the natural gasoline, all is being moved by barge now. And kind of a new wave of product that we'll be moving soon is the actual fracking water.
Oh, yeah?
And that they've been really trying to find a safe way to move it in bulk. So right now we're in the process of having the Coast Guard determine what form of regulation will be placed upon that cargo. But we're excited because we feel like we're a great option to be able to move that throughout the country in a safe and efficient manner.
How do you get to be a barge pilot? What do you have to do?
Well, right now we can take a young man that's 18 to 20 years old.
Or a woman.
All right. And they can come in, and they have to start off on the deck. And that starting wage is about $120 a day. And as they progress, they move into a tankerman role, which is actually responsible for loading and unloading the barges. That's about a $50,000 to $70,000 income. So you immediately double your income when you get a tankerman's ticket. And after you're a tankerman for 3 or 4 years, any young man or woman that just chose that career path, usually about 5 years from hire date, can be making $140,000 a year as a pilot.
Wow.
And I tell you what, Kai, you take a young man from making $30,000 a year to $140,000 a year in 5 years, that's the American dream.
Yeah, not to turn this into a recruiting tool for Golden Barge Lines, but are you away from home a lot? I mean, what's quality of life like for you guys?
Absolutely. That's the toughest part. Yeah. You're away from home about 8 months out of the year. You miss weddings, birthdays, funerals, graduations, but you're making a sacrifice that there is definitely a reward on the other side of.
Do you get out much onto the river, or are you stuck in an office?
Look, I wish I got out there more than I do. During our growth period and trying to recruit business for some of our new investment has definitely kept me from getting on the water more as much as I want to. But I love going out there. That's where the action is. And that's where our guys are making the daily sacrifice to make what our company does happen. And it's a lot more fun to be out on the water than it is in the office, I promise you.
Austin Golding is a co-owner of Golding Barge Lines down in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Thanks very much for your time once again.
Thank you for your time. Take care.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, a trivia question that will perhaps win you a drink at happy hour tonight, although maybe only if you're in some kind of weird politico-economic happy hour in Washington, D.C., probably. Dave Brat, now the Republican nominee for Eric Cantor's seat, as we talked about up top, is a Ph.D. economist. He will be the only one in the Congress of the United States if he wins. So here's the question. Who was the last one? Answer tomorrow, so you got to tune in. Or it's on Google right now, so I'll give it to you. Tom Lantos, left in 2008, Democrat of California. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace. I gave it away, I know. That's Marketplace on this, Wednesday. Today, the Dow off 102 points. The NASDAQ down 6 points. The S&P 500 dipped 6 points as well. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.